Friday night edition of the show. The Golden State Warriors are champions in blowout fashion over the Cleveland Cavaliers, 108-85. Kevin Durant, back-to-back finals MVPs. He finished with 20 points, a triple-double, and a well-earned plus 30 in this game, team best. Steph Curry, 37 points, a little bit of gunning late, 7 of 15 from 3 in a bounce-back effort. He maybe could have been the MVP if he hadn't had just such a stinker overall in Game 3, but it is Kevin Durant. LeBron James, 23 points in 41 minutes, 7 of 13 for the field, 8 assists, was revealed to have been playing with a severely contused hand after punching a whiteboard after Game 1, and he expressed his frustration basically saying that he thought some of the calls had taken the game away and they had all those other issues. We can talk more about that a little bit. I don't think that it made the difference in this series. Maybe Cleveland wins Game 3 with a better effort from him, and he certainly was still really good, but he wasn't just the absolutely dominating transcendent player that he was through his first three rounds and a game of the season. So the Warriors have now won 3 out of 4 championships, the last two with Kevin Durant in tow. Where do you want to start here as someone who has observed this run very closely over these last few years?
Well, it was kind of interesting and in a strange way appropriate how anticlimactic this was. Like, because I was thinking about it going through, and I mean, obviously the most big closeout game of these four was the one that Cleveland won, Game 7. Unbelievable game, but also went down to the last shot. And this wasn't that. And it was a very unusual season, but not all that surprising when you consider the overall context. It's very, very hard for a team to make it to 4 straight NBA finals, something both of these franchises did, which is pretty amazing. And throughout the regular season, there was this big question that you and I talked about a lot on this show, on the Twitter NBA show and in person, about whether they really had that defensive mojo or whether it was just age, you know, especially with Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala. And the answer we got on the defensive end seemed to be a pretty definitive yes, they still had it. And so what I'm going to be really interested in as we move forward, this was far more relevant against Houston than against the Cavs due to their differing defensive strengths. But I'm interested in where this team goes offensively. They've been historic over the last couple of years, and so they didn't face the same kind of challenge in the finals other than Game 1, but that's the nature of having a historically great team.
Yeah, I think last year's team to me was way better than this year's team, and this year's team, you know, with Iguodala getting hurt in Game 3 against Houston, you know, maybe we would be talking about this team on the same level if he just hadn't gotten hurt, but they did overcome that. They also got that Chris Paul injury, so that was pretty big. Whether the Rockets would have won if they had had Paul still, difficult to say. But the idea that, you know, no one can touch this team, I think that we'll see what kind of reinforcements they get this year. But I think just it really more about those top four guys all being, you know, going to start declining just a little bit here. And same thing with Iguodala. You know, I think next year, I may have said this before, would be the first year that I probably will pick the field over Golden State. This year, I would have picked Golden State over the field to win the championship, and obviously last year as well. But they will very likely be the favorites, unless maybe LeBron James ends up in Houston. That's really the only way I could see it, or unless something just absolutely crazy happened with the Lakers. But yeah, I mean, I think the amount of adversity that they did overcome this year, I mean, oh yeah, they've got 4 all-stars, blah, blah, like the fact that Curry and Thompson could play so poorly in Game 3, and yet they still were able to put up a 118 offensive rating and win because KD was so good. I understand that. But, you know, if we had kind of an average strength finals team going up against them, I think it would have been much more difficult for them than this Cavs team. And this Cavs team was flawed, other than the Raptors, who won 59 games and just for whatever reason had this huge block against the Cavs and just don't play well in the playoffs. You know, they didn't really beat any elite teams in the East playoffs. And so it was a great accomplishment for LeBron to drag these guys here. But, you know, they were overmatched, and I think everyone realized that coming in. I think this is our first final sweep since 2007, actually, which also was LeBron and a similarly talent-challenged Cavalier team. Should we talk a little bit about where this Golden State run ranks from a historical perspective at this point?
Well, I want to do more digging on it myself, but I mean, preliminarily, it is the best record, postseason record, in a 4-year span in NBA history. It is, I believe, the most regular season wins in NBA history over a 4-year span. And remember, it's been a long time since expansion. So this is not a diluted league where, you know, they're beating up on these nascent teams. That said, there are some pretty bad teams in the league, but that's different than expansion. So, I mean, it's up there, and I like to think of it just because I find this more interesting in terms of, like, the most talented team. And I think there is an argument to be made that the 2016-17 Warriors are the greatest compilation of talent that has ever been assembled in NBA history.
Yeah, that even might be the greatest team in NBA history. I mean, they're, especially when healthy that year, and then going through 16-1 in the playoffs, winning their first 15, although obviously the Kawhi Leonard injury had something to do with that. But any of these other teams that had similar luck along the way, to be sure.
Right. And so, I mean, they're in that conversation. They are an unquestioned dynasty. However you're going to define it, 3 and 4 counts. I mean, that's just the way it is. And the one they lost, they had 73 wins, and that whole season was definitive for a different reason. So that's an accomplishment. And it is, there has been a lot of turnover over that time, largely due to the cap space they had to clear to get Kevin Durant in the first place. But they're a historic unit, and it'll be very interesting. I mean, there a lot of people try to do legacy talk and all those conversations at the time, but the truth of the matter, and this is for me more growing up a football and baseball fan, is that you lose a lot of that context over time. It's really 10 years, 15 years down the road that those talks really happen. And so a lot of the injuries, a lot of the, you know, to that team or their opponents, or, you know, obviously the Durant thing is going to be the Durant thing, but a lot of those things kind of wash away. And so people fixate on it in the immediate of the, oh, this guy was hurt, oh, that guy was hurt. Well, those things count. You know, the Warriors very, very reasonably could say that they could say that they wouldn't have won. Like, you could say they wouldn't have won a championship this year if Chris Paul doesn't get hurt. Certainly an argument to be made there. But that's just the nature of the NBA. It's an endurance race. It's a battle of attrition and everything else. So it's a remarkable accomplishment.
And they had guys hurt, like Steph Curry.
Yeah.
And I don't think people have talked enough about, you know, he didn't win finals MVP. We can talk about that a little bit, but to play at a level that was certainly at a finals MVP later level, he just had someone who was even greater than him on his team. I mean, I can't think of another time when a player has missed almost a month and a half and then just come back in the middle of the playoffs and be able to refine that level of form. You know, I mean, he was, well, and we didn't even talk about the fact that he was, you know, missed all this time and he had to just get it back during the playoffs. Like, that generally doesn't happen.
The other one that is already falling by the wayside is Klay Thompson has been playing pretty damn hurt for this entire series. I mean, he had what looked like a catastrophic leg injury like 5 minutes into game one. It ended up not being that, you know, he ended up still playing through the series. I bet we'll find out about, like, really the full extent of that at some point. You know, obviously Iguodala's whole issue, and that's playoff basketball. I wish that weren't the case. I wish we could flip injuries off for it. Sure. I think everybody would. But that's a part of the story now. It is a part of it before. There's no real way for the NBA to work around it. And it's not like they, you know, other than 2015, they have been extraordinarily, well, I guess they were lucky in 17, but they would have run pretty cleanly through everybody anyway. Maybe Spurs take a couple games, but, like, I mean, so you appreciate that for what it is, but you want to talk about MVP? I don't find it too sexy, but we could talk about it a little bit.
Well, I do want to hit one other thing, since you're on the subject of injuries. Obviously, this LeBron hand injury, it did affect the series. It seems he was 7 of 14 on jumpers in game one and only 4 of 14 on jumpers the entire rest of the way. So he was not looking to take the jump shot. The Warriors were playing him. You know, it wasn't like he had all these chances to pull up. I think the Warriors helped to take away the jump shot to some degree, but he definitely wasn't looking for it as much. And then I thought, even more significantly, perhaps the ankle injury that he suffered in the first half of game three, he really looked like he didn't have anywhere close to his usual explosion after that. I thought pretty much every contested layup that he took in this game, he missed. And, you know, he was stopping and, like, pump faking to draw fouls around the rim. You just don't see that from him normally. You know, he's playing just a much more controlled game. And I think between the eye thing, between this hand thing, which admittedly is self-inflicted, between that contusion that he suffered in game six of the Celtics series when Nance fell into him, it was pretty incredible how he still managed. For everyone who's like, oh, it's just LeBron, all he does is he just, you know, he overpowers guys, he's so much better physically, like, his physicality was compromised at various points in these playoffs, and he still managed to put up a very solid line. And we saw just how miserable Cleveland was offensively in the second half. In this game, 13 points in the third and then 14 points during the competitive portion of the fourth quarter, to the extent it was competitive. And when he wasn't just having that unbelievable game, you see how limited this team was going up against this Warriors defense. So yeah, we can talk MVP now. Actually, no, here, let's do a read first from our friends at Sonos, who have revolutionized the way I've been watching TV. We've been watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation, Lord of the Rings. I watched the new Star Wars movie the other day. I've actually been watching a lot more movies lately just because the sound quality is so good. And I use their up and running service where they actually, if you live in a major metropolitan area, they will come to your house and actually install it for you. And the sound quality is so good because they actually like take a smartphone around the room, listen to the speaker, and then the speaker is able to adjust based on what it sounds like in the room. So you make sure that wherever you're sitting in the room, you get awesome sound. Also using the Sonos One to control music with voice commands, which is great when you have company over and you want to just throw something on without being buried in your phone. The speakers are very easy to set up. I watched them very carefully while they did it. But as I said, if you use that up and running service, they'll just do it all for you. Anyway, you order from Sonos.com, you select up and running at checkout if you qualify. Sonos, of course, is offering a special deal to Dunked On listeners. You can get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. Use the promo code DUNK10, different promo code here than the usual, DUNK10, DUNC10. At Sonos.com, this offer is available for a limited time only, cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Once again, 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com with that code DUNK10, DUNC10. Let them know that you came from us with that DUNK10 code. You agree with the MVP selection?
I think it was a pretty close call, but I think that what gets lost in this, especially when we're talking about valuable, I mean, certainly Kevin Durant was spectacular in game three. That was the best performance of any Warrior in this series. But just like was the case in 2015 when Curry deserved the MVP and didn't get it, I think a lot of the value that he provides to the team by the attention that he draws and the way the offense runs through him can get lost in the shuffle when he is not scoring. And there is certainly an argument that, especially when he's engaged on defense, that Kevin Durant is the best player. You know, he had some really nice help defensive plays, especially in the last two games, and he was better rebounding after the debacle at the end of game one. But if we're going to define it in terms of value, I guess I would have Curry slightly ahead. But again, it's pretty close to a dead heat this year. And so for me, I don't know, I guess tie goes to the person who I think is more important overall, and that will be Curry.
Yeah, I think it's a little unfair because of all the controversy in game one that Curry's clutch performance in that game was lost. I mean, you remember he had that huge and one to actually put the Warriors up after they were down two. And then he had a nice overtime as well. He was pretty good down the end of that game. And KD was awful in game one, but on both ends, I thought, particularly defensively, although, you know, he did have the LeBron assignment, but his defense was a big reason why LeBron put up 51 in that game. You know, I thought Curry was the better player in three of the four games, but then his game two was, or his game three was just so bad, the 3 out of 16, that it was difficult. And KD probably gave more defensive value. But also Curry, I thought, had a really nice defensive series, as he did against the Rockets as well. I mean, the number of times that, you know, LeBron just like took advantage of Curry, there were a few of those times. You know, and part of that was because they had Tristan Thompson on the floor. They just didn't have the level of spacing, and there was no Kyrie Irving to worry about either. But
yeah. Well, and also remember that they were giving Klay less dangerous assignments for a lot of this series, especially in game one and game two, because he was coming back from an injury. They had him off George Hill, which is usually who Klay would be guarding if he had been full strength.
Yeah. Well, in any event, I think if I had a vote, I would have voted for Curry, in part just because, and it's very rare that I would do this. I mean, I think it was pretty close to a dead heat. I certainly understand voting for KD. The voting ended up being 7-4 in favor of KD, but I would do it just for like the legacy purposes, which seems kind of weird to say, but especially because he got robbed in 2010, or I'm sorry, in 2015. I thought that was pretty unfair. But, you know, it's funny. I think part of what hurts him in these series is that like he'll have one really bad game. Like that in some ways is like the nature of just his game. He takes a lot of threes. He takes a lot of difficult shots. There's going to be one game in there where he just doesn't play well. But that really seems to like sour people on him. Like in 2015, it was that game two when he was like 6 out of 23 and they ended up losing in overtime. You know, if it hadn't been for that game, he probably wins it in 2015. So that he always kind of has this one game, and you know, no one is going to be like, oh, but he's still a great gravity in that game, even though, you know, he's probably the best. If you had to pick one guy in NBA history to have on your team, but you know that he's going to go 3 for 16 in the game, he would probably be the guy. But, you know, that's not the way these things kind of work. So ultimately, I would have gone with Curry. I think that he, you know, has been a good enough player that he should have that on his resume. As I mentioned, I didn't agree with the Iguodala one in 2015. But Kevin Durant is certainly a worthy choice. And it's not like Steph Curry didn't play well. I mean, he played at a higher level than many a finals MVP in the past. It's just that he also had Kevin Durant on it.
Yeah, I don't really have much else to add there. Any other kind of takeaways from this game? I thought that one thing that was notable is that no Cavs really had a strong performance. I mean, there were players that had little stretches, but nobody really stood out. I mean, we talked about LeBron struggles, and he had a solid game, but it wasn't a LeBron spectacular or anything like that. And, you know, that certainly made it harder for them to come out with a win, but they weren't going to win this. They weren't going to win this game. When the Warriors were engaged defensively and had that 13-3 lead early on, you're like, okay, I think I know where this is going.
Yeah, you felt like Cleveland's only chance in this one was to get a big lead early. And in fact, it was Golden State. Cleveland came back a couple of times, were able to take brief leads. But other than that, the Warriors seemed to be in control most of the way, led by 9 at halftime. That, I thought, the biggest shot of the game was Curry at the end of the first half. Steve Kerr takes a timeout to get him back in because they're worried about foul trouble with him. He slips the screen. He's got LeBron on him. LeBron knew exactly what they're running. He slips the screen, gets open, pump fakes just enough to get LeBron's hands down, and then actually shoots it over him for the three to give him a 9-point lead. I think that took a lot of the air out of Cleveland at the end of the half. I mean, LeBron messing up his hand to the point where it affects his performance by hitting the whiteboard, like, that's pretty sorry. It's a shame that happened, but I mean, to get that bent out of shape, it seemed like mostly because of the refs and then a teammate's mistake. And, you know, they had like the viral video of him just sitting there and, like, you know, not interacting with his teammates after the JR gaffe, which, by the way, I've said this on Twitter. I did not say it on the show, that the Cavs were better off from that gaffe than if JR just never gets the offensive rebound. Because if he doesn't get the offensive rebound, then Golden State has a chance to win it in regulation. At least he got the offensive rebound and took the possession away from Golden State, even if, you know, he obviously made a huge blunder afterwards. It's still, the entire sequence overall was positive. But, like, you know, it was funny that JR makes this great play to get the rebound, then makes a dumb play after that. And it was, like, so deflating to Cleveland. I thought, you know, LeBron can be a little bit difficult to play with sometimes. You know, people always talk about what a great leader he is, but he's moody. And this was certainly an example of that, of like, I mean, what are you thinking if you're LeBron's teammate in that huddle and he's just utterly despondent? Like, you're not, and you saw they came out and played in the overtime. You know, there's the idea that, you know, the game was over. I mean, it seemed like that he was just so upset, and then so upset after the game, you know, like, they had a chance still to win the game in overtime. So it was, I mean, I'm not going to kill LeBron. I think he, with this playoffs, you know, at some point we'll have to do a reassessment of whether he or Jordan is the greatest player of all time. But he has made that a conversation, and he's still, you know, at 33 playing at probably a higher level than Jordan was playing at 33, which is amazing to think about it, because Jordan probably has the best longevity other than maybe Kareem of any player in NBA history. So I'm not a LeBron hater by any means, but, you know, I do think that he can kind of, the team takes their cue from him in some respects, with the drama, with the defensive effort, with the not trying in the regular season, and then with things like this, you know, and then breaking his hand. I mean, that's just, you know, there have been other players who've done that, like Larry Bird famously suffered this nebulous hand injury for maybe getting into a bar fight in the 1985 finals and didn't play well after that. But, you know, that's kind of sorry. Like, he should be better than that. Like, that is a big mistake, and it really hurt his team's chances of winning, and that's something that he's going to have to own.
There are certain characteristics that I just expect to see in a LeBron James team moving forward, a lot of that informed by this season. And I wonder how that roller coaster ride is going to play out if it is somewhere other than Cleveland. I mean, you think about what happened this year where they just, I mean, some of it was personnel, but they were just flat on defense the entire regular season. And they were better, certainly, in the playoffs than they were in the regular season, but they had the good fortune of facing teams that weren't really suited to take advantage of their foibles enough. Like, if Boston had Kyrie or Gordon Hayward, I think they would have had a much better, you know, go of it. I think they would have won that series. And, you know, things not working out and LeBron being a factor in them effectively turning over half the team at the trade deadline, you know, that's going to happen, I think, at moments in time. And the juice is worth the squeeze with LeBron James because he's still the best. I think he's still the best player in the world when he's engaged. I mean, we'll see what happens with his defense. I thought his defense overall was very disappointing in these finals.
It would be nice if he didn't have to be the best defensive player on a team anymore. That might be nice.
Right, right. And he will have the opportunity to ensure that is not the case, should he choose to prioritize that over the other many things he could prioritize. But I'm really fascinated to see where this goes and to see what he takes away from these 4 years in Cleveland. And I watched a little bit of his podium post game, and he talked about, you know, playing with smart players and all this stuff about kind of like why he left for Miami.
Yeah, he's really been harping on that.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. And so I wonder about, you know, with LeBron, I as somebody who has talked with him a couple times before, he understands the way that his words are analyzed and construed and everything else. So I wonder where this is going for him. I'm sure he has some thoughts already. And also, I want to express my deep, both self-interested and not self-interested hope that he can decide faster than like 10 days into July, because I'm not ready for that.
Yeah, well, hopefully my sports business classroom students are hoping he decides faster, because hopefully I could be engaged in that instead of like having to worry about like all the signings that happened, like 97 signings in one day, like back in 2014. But we have a lot, we could talk much more about LeBron's future going forward. We'll do a Cavs offseason preview at some point, same for the Warriors. But last thing I wanted to say here about Golden State, I believe that this is the greatest four-year stretch that any team had in NBA history since the Russell Celtics, and that was just such a different era. And I might even, just because the Warriors have dominated so much in the regular season, and then their point differential in the playoffs, and their point differential in the playoffs this year was awesome too, right? I mean, I don't know where it ended up, but I think they had over a 10 net rating in the playoffs this year. You know, that would be another like probably top five playoffs in terms of net rating. I think they had the highest ever last year. You know, 2015 was not as dominant, but they had, you know, an all-time great regular season that year. Had the 73 wins, obviously, in the year that they didn't win it. You do make a little bit of a delineation between the first 2 years and the second 2 years because of adding Kevin Durant. But, you know, it's hard to say, like, oh, those are the same Warriors in 2015 as they are now. But a lot of the things are the same. Draymond Green, the switching, the beautiful system that they run. But, yeah, I mean, this is... If I would be hard pressed to point out a better 4 year stretch in NBA history than this one.
I just went back through. So the Warriors ended up with a plus 11.4 net rating this year
in the playoffs.
That is in the playoffs. That is the fourth best net rating in the playoffs over the last decade. Number one being the Warriors last year. Two is, I believe it was the Spurs the year that they won the title over Miami, 14. And then, interestingly, the other one was a team that didn't win the championship. That was the Dwight Howard Magic.
Yeah, that team just dominated the first two rounds. And then, and I think they even won their two games against the Celtics in, like, relative blowouts. That was a weird series. They went down 3-0, won two in a row, and then lost game six on the road. But, yeah, I mean, the only other stretches that would come to mind, and for a four-year stretch, obviously there's the three-peats from the Lakers, but then on the years on either side of that, they didn't make it to the finals. The Bulls, you know, maybe you could say 1990, they got to game seven of the conference finals, and then they won three in a row from 91 to 93. But they had pretty difficult playoff runs in 92 and 93. You know, you might look at the Spurs from 03 to 07, but they lost in the second round in 2004 and 2006, even though they had maybe the best regular season team both of those years. That Heat team that made it to the finals four straight years, you could look at that too. But they really weren't close to winning in 2014. Really only had one dominating regular season during that period. So I would put that below this team. You know, the second three-peat Bulls, again, you know, you have to bring in the 95 season when they lost in the second round. The Lakers from 85 to 88 won three out of four championships, but lost in five to the Houston Rockets in 1986 in the conference finals. The Celtics from 84 to 87 only won two titles, but did make it to four straight finals. So, yeah, I mean, when you combine regular season and postseason dominance. Certainly the Warriors have as good a case of anybody, and I think when you combine those two, you'd probably have to put them highest, especially when you look at the 73 wins and losing in game seven of the finals in the 1 year that they didn't.
I think that's as good a place as any to end, and we have some other fun topics to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of dealing with the consequences of actions, although how much of them were his, perhaps will never be known. Brian Colangelo has been fired. We didn't get a chance to talk about it yesterday since we extended the week out to do this show today with game four today. I thought the statements were interesting. The Sixers, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, and 97 other names, law firm concluded basically that they could not show affirmatively that Colangelo did any of the posting from the five accounts. You know, he admitted to the one which didn't post at all, but then they did conclude that his wife was involved with some of the accounts, though, and I guess all of them. However, she did a factory reset of her iPhone before handing it over to them. So that significantly complicated the investigation. A lot of times in a legal proceeding, if you destroy evidence, you are then in the discovery process, you then have a sanction against you of basically a finding of fact that, you know, would be negative. It's just assumed that whatever that evidence is would have gone against you. And I think that's the fact that she factory reset her phone might be a pretty good indicator. There is still also unexplained, even under this idea that, oh, she was acting alone, is the fact that when the Philly organization was told about two of the five Twitter accounts, that the other three went private immediately. The only explanation that might save Brian Colangelo there is he, because he apparently mentioned a lot of stuff to his wife, mentioned this, hey, you know, this is really weird, like, I can't believe this happened. And she was like, oh shit, I better like make these private.
Well, and if so, remember that his original statements made it sound like he knew nothing about what was going on. And right. So that gets a little bit dicey too, where like, so you inform somebody and then you don't hear them go like, oh, those are mine or something like that. That would be problematic too.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that like his wife didn't come clean at that, and you know, you can say, you know, everyone talks to their wife, you know, like this is, I mean, now, number one, they made the right decision to fire him. We were saying that since day one on this, because it's better for the organization to move on from him, right? That's obvious. But now if we're talking about this, you know, it's not really fair to him because, you know, we all tell our wives stuff and like, well, yeah, we might, but we all don't marry someone who's dumb enough to post all this stuff, right? Apparently, in the best possible interpretation to him, like, lied about what she was doing even after she was exposed.
And it doesn't have to be fair. I don't understand, like, when you are in and this is something I've dealt with in non-sports contexts, if you are in a position of power, what people around you do can matter, and you know what? In 99.99% of circumstances, those people know it too. So even if it wasn't Colangelo, you know, that's them's the breaks. You know, like, there are these expectations on everybody involved.
You exercise judgment in who you tell this information to. If you're going to do it, you damn well better be sure it's not somebody who's going to go like post shit on Twitter.
Yeah. And the burden is a lot lower now. It's a lot easier to get stuff out there. You know, like, it's not like burner ravens or snail mail or something like it used to be. But that isn't an excuse. The threshold of candor of whatever else is still high. And, you know, it takes the family. If you, as you said, whoever you share this information with, you have to trust it. And it's unfortunate if he wasn't a bad actor in any of it. But that's pretty irrelevant. And now the Sixers get to find a new general manager. They gave the temporary power to Brett Brown. And so I had these, first of all, I was worried because there is not a good Rock Divers with him, considering.
Because it's an alliteration. Can I finish up on Colangelo real quick, though, before we talk about the Sixers going forward? Also recall that he claimed in a text message to Jordan Schultz that he was being set up. Nope, don't think you were. I mean, unless he was just talking about whoever revealed this, which will perhaps forever remain a mystery, but you know, it was his wife. If he couldn't have realized that by that point, and he just, you know, again, it's like, it, once you make the decision to share any confidential information with anyone, you own the consequences of that decision. It's like, oh yeah, maybe his wife shouldn't have done this, fine, but like, he's the one who made the decision to share the information with someone. Now, his statement afterwards, I thought, was very Colangelo-esque, let's put it that way, in just its tone deafness. They had these rabbit ears. They were terrible managing the media. in part because they're so worried about what people thought the whole time, it seems like. But he basically said, I never recklessly shared any information. That's what the Paul Weiss statement said. I vigorously dispute that characterization. Well, how did she find out about it then? Was she like Bodner said this on his pod today, is she like having a conversation with Mark Eversley or Ned Cohen and getting it from there, all of this stuff? So that's number one. You know, just kind of throwing his wife under the bus. I mean, what he should have said was, I did not post those tweets. They do not reflect my views, which they probably do reflect his views because I'm guessing she got it from somewhere. But nonetheless, that's what you would say, is they don't reflect my views. But I take full responsibility for what happened and I've learned my lesson and blah, blah. Like, he's never going to get a GM job again. Maybe he could get some consultant role or something like that. But like, that's what you say here, is you take responsibility instead of basically like throwing your wife under the bus and saying, well, we do have to work through this. Like, my wife made a mistake. Nah, you made a mistake too here, man. Like, and clearly he was discussing these matters with her with a vehemence that like informed her tweeting. That's one part. Another part is, it's still not even clear that part of it wasn't him or that there wasn't someone else in the Colangelo family as well, because, you know, some of these tweets were like referencing like Mark Aguirre back in the 80s. Like, I am skeptical that his wife, and had like a very different tone as well. Also, like, some of the Eric Jr. tweets were like said posted from Android and she had an iPhone. So that's certainly some interesting circumstantial evidence there as well. So the whole thing is crazy. Yeah.
Let me say one other thing. And again, this is an if true statement.
Yeah.
If the speculation that is out there that Jerry Colangelo tried to put his thumb on the scale.
That is not speculation. That is reported by multiple sources to Kyle Newbeck.
Okay, so if that's there, he has to be fired. There is no, because if you are so biased that you want to influence the process when somebody who should be fired in all other circumstances other than that they are your progeny.
Well, it wasn't just putting his thumb on the scale. It wasn't like, oh, hey, guys, I'd really appreciate it if you could keep him. Supposedly it was, oh, I'm going to wreck your relationships around the league if you fire him.
Yeah.
That's what the reporting was.
So don't let the door hit you on the way out. I mean, that is unforgivable from a perspective. And I know Jerry Colangelo has this big reputation, and certainly this does not affect all of that. But if you're going to put yourself on the line for your kid when he screws up, then you don't deserve to have a position of trust.
No, I mean, that would just, if he really threatened to do that, that would just be so incredibly weak. And it's just, I mean, whether it was Adam Silver, whether it was the Colangelos angling in, I mean, it's frankly, given how they came to power, the fact that they have conducted themselves this poorly, as I mentioned this, right? Like, if you had to pick an NBA general manager, there's one other one who I won't name who would be on that list for me as well, who is very media conscious and has rabbit ears as well. But he would have been in the top two and probably the top one for like that this would have happened to. And just the way they came to power was, and then the fact that it ended up being Brian Colangelo after, you know, the only other candidate interviewed was Danny Ferry, ironically enough, another scandal plate guy. It's just frankly, like, I'm glad to see the back of these guys.
No arguments here, but we have a lot of other news to get to. The place I want to start, this is just brief, but from Albert Namad, who you and I both respect his work on this a lot, he is projecting the BRI to end up at about $7.1 billion, and that would mean the salary cap would go to $101 million, which is the estimate that the league has been using now for, I think, about a year.
Yeah, and he also noted that the average number of playoff games is 84. There were 82 this year, so should be right about the same level. We had a very short second round, a long conference finals. First round was about average, and obviously the finals was short. This is interesting. Justin, if I don't pronounce your name correctly. He spoke with Kiki Vandeweghe a few days ago, and the NBA will be experimenting with a challenge flag during Summer League, which they also has existed in the G League already. And I really like that. I like that better than some of these other reviews. I mean, I'm not saying they should eliminate all the other reviews, but I think that could help keep the game moving a little bit more. It could also even just, you know, review just some completely ridiculous foul calls that could maybe get overturned in the last couple minutes. I want to see what the implementation is, and I admit that I'm not that familiar with how they did it in the G League, but I'll be looking forward to that for Summer League, although having to pay attention to the end of Summer League games might be difficult. In Boston, Gordon Hayward had surgery to have hardware removed from that ankle, and he's expected to be ready for training camp, blah, blah. doesn't seem like his rehab really went all that well, right? I mean, you remember when it first happened, like Chef Randolph was like, oh yeah, I had the same injury. I was back in like, I don't know what it was, but it was like 6 months or something. And people were talking about how he might be able to come back. And Danny Ainge noted that in February, he started going a little bit harder and had a little bit of a setback. And now he's having the surgery, which, you know, as far as I know, that's not like supposed to be part of the plan that like, oh yeah, by the way, you have a second surgery whenever you had this injury. And so it sounds like something, you know, there's some irritation or something, there's swelling that was being caused by the hardware that it had to be removed. So that's not encouraging. It doesn't sound like his rehab has gone amazingly well, but you know, we'll see what he looks like next year, obviously.
And as is true for every team, but I mean, considering their history, we're gonna have to think about it. Boston's ceiling is going to be determined a lot by health. I mean, Kyrie Irving, we'll have to see what's going on with his knee moving forward. I don't worry as much about Gordon Hayward long term, but you know, the longer things last. On a positive injury news, this was like a week ago, but Woj reported that Patrick Beverley has been cleared to return to full basketball activities 3 months ahead of schedule. He had microfracture, and that's just absolutely fabulous news. Beverley, a great competitor, has this amazing structured contract still where he has a non-guarantee for next year. And I thought the only way he was going to become a free agent would have been if like there was some sort of major setback. So
yeah,
good to see him back. That doesn't mean he'll necessarily be a Clipper next year, but he will be playing on that contract and I'm happy to have him back.
Yeah. His guarantee date is later though, I believe. I think it might be, let me double check this. Yeah. His guarantee date is the league-wide cutdown date. So there'd be no reason for the Clippers to cut him unless they wanted to like use cap space or something like that, that he was. And so worth noting also that if they want to trade him, his salary would have to be guaranteed to count for anything, or he could basically be traded for nothing as well. So, you know, it's interesting to say that this is 3 months ahead of schedule. I mean, he had the surgery pretty early on in the season, as I recall. And, you know, you remember Amari Stoudemire had microfracture back in 2005. And actually, you know, he ended up having to get shut down again for the season, but he actually like came back like 4 months later. So I think they've extended the timeline out a little bit, but yeah, hopefully he will be healthy. He's obviously had a number of knee issues. Woj also reporting that the Nuggets might use the 14th pick as a way to try and get off of Kenneth Faried's salary. That seems like a pretty damn steep price if you're just talking about 1 year and like $13 million. Now, maybe if they could get off of Arthur as well, that's something we talked about in their offseason preview, or maybe they get something back in addition. You know, it doesn't mean it's just going to be a straight up swap there, but you know, that would be very early and also fitting with our feeling that, you know, the Nuggets are not going to go into the season way, way over the tax as they currently project to be if Jokic signs for the max or near the max.
And if that's the price that they're willing to pay or close to it, then there's a group of teams that have money they could spend in both, you know, as cap space teams in 18 and 19 that could take on money. Then there's a separate group that, like the Suns, that probably only want to spend money for this league year, for the league year that is upcoming.
Yeah.
They should just be fighting hard to try to make this deal if that's what they're going to do, because other than Mason Plumlee, all of Denver's bad money is expiring. So if they're trying to unload it and they have that pick, that's who you're talking to right now.
In Detroit, with a regime change there, they still are looking for an official general manager. Jeff Bauer has parted ways with Detroit. It seemed like Woj was kind of like doing Bauer a solid by the number of times he was mentioning him and like saying that he was like still a candidate to be the GM. And like, since he was Stan Van Gundy's handpicked GM, that always seemed exceedingly unlikely to me. And then it's really odd here. You know, remember they brought in Ed Stefanski, who then brought in noted NBA forward-thinking visionaries Bernie Bickerstaff and Jim Lynham to head up the coaching search, but they don't have a GM yet, do they? Like, so they're going to bring in a coach before the GM. That seemed to be making more progress with that. They're down to now Dwayne Casey. John Beilein of Michigan interviewed there, but removed his name from consideration. Sarunas Jasikevicius, yeah, I'm blowing that, I know. It's been a while.
Jasikevicius.
I'll just call him Saras. That's his nickname. Ime Udoka and Kenny Smith are the four candidates that it sounds like it's down to. Casey is an interesting case because he's owed over $6 million by Toronto this season. And so presumably they would have to pay, and they got to pay Stan $7 million for this year already. So yeah, there's an offset, but the reason that Casey presumably is like, well, I don't have to work this year. I mean, I don't know that he's going to be like, this will probably be his last job since he's in his 60s already. I don't know that Detroit is like some amazing destination, but I'm not sure like other teams would be lining up next year. And I think you noted that they don't project to be maybe as many openings next offseason, but it makes it interesting because if he's already getting paid six, it's like, well, why would I take this now? Oh, maybe because you're going to pay me some big amount beyond this year. And, you know, that could be an issue as well. But yeah, the last team that hired the coach before the GM was Sacramento in 2013. And that didn't go too well. Speaking of Sacramento.
Well, and wait, wasn't that also the reigning coach of the year?
What? No. When they hired George Karl. No. They hired Mike Malone. And then they fired Mike Malone and they brought in Karl.
That's right. Yeah. I was going to say that would be a really weird parallel between those two circumstances.
They hired Malone and then they hired Pete D'Alessandro as the GM shortly thereafter. But I can't believe you messed up my transition to Sacramento where
I wanted to make sure you had the voice ready.
That Iman Shumpert is opted into his $11 million player option for the 2018-19 season per Shams Charania of Yahoo Sports. And much as it pains me to use that voice, A, after we just did a live show for 3 hours, and B, for my fellow OPRF, Oak Park River Forest High School alum, Iman Shumpert, but I don't think he was.
I am hoping that he can play a little bit next year, whether it's for the Kings or somebody else. But
yeah, it'd be nice if he could resurrect his career. I mean, he basically just, I don't think he, if he played a minute for the Kings, I don't remember him getting on the floor much, if at all. He just was continuing to struggle with leg injuries. In Milwaukee, the two sides, the Bucks and Fox Sports, have agreed to a 7-year deal worth a little bit more than $200 million per Sports Business Journal. It starts at $26 million for the Bucks rights next year and goes up 4%. That's from a payout that was in the low $20 million range last season. I'm a little bit surprised, actually, that that's as big as the increase is. Like, the ratings were up. They've got Giannis, although, you know, they might not have Giannis 2 years from now. We'll see. But, I mean, I'm not sure when this deal would have been signed, but, you know, the previous one. But I'm surprised it's not more of an increase than that. I mean, and for Milwaukee, maybe that's pretty good. But this isn't some, like, oh, break the bank, the Bucks have all this money now. It's, you know, a couple million dollars a year increase, which, you know, maybe we've seen for a lot of these franchises, just the timing. You know, I think there was a time in 2013, 2014, the Lakers signed that enormous deal with Time Warner, which is now Spectrum, Sportsnet, and then the national deal. And we haven't seen just these like blockbuster figures. And the Warriors, they redid their deal back in like 2010. They are getting very little in terms of local TV. You know, if that were on the free market right now, you know, that'd probably be like $75 million or something. I have the speculation, but I don't think they're getting like even 50 at this point. Comcast is getting an amazing deal from them. If that had been more, maybe the Bucks luxury tax would be easier to pay. We'll see. What else we got here?
Speaking of teams that are dealing with the luxury tax, New Orleans Pelicans, it was notable earlier in the offseason, they picked up Alvin Gentry's option for next season. It is not a surprise that they, on top of that, negotiated a true extension. And so now he is extended through the 2020-21 season per team official ruling.
All right, we'll be back momentarily here to talk a little Trae Young. Can't wait to get to this one. I was very curious to see what was there with him. But first, this from Omaha Steaks. We still got time before Father's Day to get an awesome Omaha Steaks Father's Day package for only $49.99. They deliver hand-trimmed, flash-frozen, and vacuum-sealed meats directly to your door in an Omaha Steaks cooler. Got mine a couple of weeks ago. They sent it a little early for Father's Day, but they wanted me to have a chance to try it out so I could talk about it to you guys. And we went to a barbecue last weekend, brought over a couple of the filet mignons, a couple of the sirloins, a couple of the hot dogs, and definitely all that stuff was a big hit. Had a bunch of people try it just out of the goodness of my heart, and also so I could talk about it and see if they liked it. They did. Aside from the hot dogs, the two filet mignons, the two sirloins, you get four chicken fried steaks, which I have not had a chance to try yet, but I'm certainly fired up for as soon as I can eat carbs again. Two boneless pork chops, four all beef Omaha Steak burgers, plus four more Omaha Steak burgers free with your purchase. A pound of steakhouse fries, 12 ounces of all beef meatballs, which I really enjoyed, and four caramel apple tartlets, in addition to an Omaha Steak seasoning packet. This limited time package is only $49.99. When you go to omahasteaks.com, at the very beginning, just type in cap space in the search bar. That'll take you right to that Father's Day package. Once again, omahasteaks.com. Type that code CAPSPACE in the search bar to get this amazing deal. Don't wait, this offer ends soon. Make sure you use that CAPSPACE code in the search bar to let them know that you came from us. All right, I'm going to start this with a question on Trae Young. Why isn't Trae Young in contention to be the number one pick?
Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
Like, I want to hear the negatives first, because I mean, just what he did statistically this year and a lot of what he put on film, I mean, was pretty damn impressive. Like what is the reason why we're not talking about him at the top of this draft with the way that we know the modern NBA game is and how big shooting and ball handling?
Okay, a couple of different things. One of the games I watched was against Kansas State. It was ended up being, and I didn't know this at the time, it was recommended to me as one to watch for him, a game playing against, I think his name is Brent Brown, who is the point guard for Kansas State. He's a legit athlete. Like, I don't know if he's an NBA player. I didn't watch much K-State this year. And Trae Young wasn't creating as much separation. He was forcing some shots. And also, when he played against Alabama's bigger, you know, they put bigs on him, he wasn't able to attack that in the same way.
You're talking about they're switching?
They didn't even switch. They just straight up put a 6'8" guy on Trae Young for the second half of that game. He wasn't creating a ton of separation. And the other point for me is you're dealing in rarefied air here. I mean, one of the stats that I have a couple of just ridiculous Trae Young stats, is that he had the number 11 usage in the last decade at any level of Division I basketball. And when you think about all the small college guys that take a ton of shots, that's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, sportsreference.com tracks usage from 2009-10 onward, and his 37% usage is the second highest of any draft prospect since then. Jimmer Fredette, gulp.
Number eight.
Had 37.8% usage. Trae had 37.1%, and then the other guys who were over 35% in terms of draft prospects, Doug McDermott, his senior year, 36, TJ Warren, 35.5%, and Alan Williams, who is playing at UCSB, a smaller school, 35%. So among guys who played in high major conferences, he was has the highest usage since 2009-10 among draft prospects.
And of the 100 highest usages, Trae Young was 16th in true shooting at 5.85, which is strong. I mean, you think about some of the other guys, like Alan Williams, his true shooting is going to be high because he did a lot of dunking back when he was a banana. He was a gaucho. That's what Santa Barbara is. I should know this. And so you have that. And then also, Trae Young attempted 10.3 three-pointers per game. That is actually the same frequency that's in terms of attempts per game that Steph Curry did his sophomore year at Davidson. His junior year, Curry actually took fewer threes. And that gets into something that's hard here. So again, you're dealing with rarefied air. Curry, those 2 years, sophomore year, 10.3 threes at 44%. Junior year, 9.9, 39%. Redick was in the low 40s. And he was similar attempt rate, though Redick's offensive role was different than Trae Young's. And so the biggest reason for me that Trae Young isn't that level is that I don't think he's as good a shooter as those guys are. He's very good, but I don't think he's that level.
And that's one of the reasons, that's one knock against him, is maybe the ball just doesn't go in as much. You know, he shot 36% from downtown. The other reason, of course, is just that he's not athletic, right? Like, that's got to be the other reason, really. It's just not quite quick enough. He'll get attacked defensively, you know. We haven't looked at all these guys yet, but you have to say that I think it'd be hard for me to find someone who has a higher offensive upside in this draft than him. And let's get to that shooting first. We can talk about that, right? I mean, this guy probably had the greenest light in major college basketball, maybe since like Pete Maravich was averaging 40 a game for LSU back in the late 60s. You mentioned that, you know, the 36% Clean the Glass had a great look at this. I'll add some other stats as well. So here's what Clean the Glass found about that 36. They looked at his 325 threes, which is just, that's an insane volume, right? Like, so, you know, we talk about guys like Justice Winslow, like, oh yeah, you shot 41% on like 50 attempts or something. This is like, and you need 750 attempts to know whether a guy's a good three-point shooter. He got like half of that just in one college season. So 241 of his 325 threes were from beyond the NBA arc. And this is, keep in mind, this guy's a freshman too, so he's younger than a lot of the guys that you're talking about. He was 33% on shots beyond the NBA arc. Of those 241, 102 of them came from 30 feet or more, 6 feet beyond the NBA line. I mean, if you watch this guy in film, I'm sure most of our listeners have at least seen him, some of these crazy shots that he hit. And of those 30 footers, he only was 26% on. And not only are those just like, a lot of those were like hard shots too. Like he wasn't even like wide open on those either, So his shot selection, you mentioned that crazy usage rate, dragged down his shooting percentage. So, and he took 78% of his threes off the dribble. And it only hit 34% of those. So there's certainly, you say, hey, can this guy get himself good enough looks? The shot selection was pretty crazy. Certainly, like, had Steph Curry not come along in the NBA, he wouldn't have been allowed to take those shots. Steph Curry, when he was at Davidson, was not taking shots of that were this ridiculous. He was working without the ball off screens a lot more as well. But there's reason to believe that when he's open, it's going to go in. So on catch and shoots, he had 81 points on 58 possessions. Awesome. Unguarded catch and shoots, 14 to 21. All those are threes. 42 points on 21 possessions. So he had a 100 E field goal percentage on unguarded catch and shoots. Pretty crazy that he only got 21 of those the entire season. Go ahead.
Well, other people have to ball for you to get an unguarded catch and shoot.
Yeah, no, and they didn't really have much other guard play as well. I mean, there's part of that was why he played the way that he did. And he basically, he didn't, when he was shooting those, he was coming off of screens, he didn't really have much chance to shoot catch and shoot jumpers out of spot up situations either. Like he was 9 out of 28 on those, and that's probably just a lot of flaming bags. Off screens, 11 out of 22. So that's pretty decent too. And then on handoffs, 13 out of 25. So when he was getting shots off the ball was really going in for him. So there's some overlap in all those categories that I just mentioned. So that's a reason to believe that if he's taking shots that aren't this ridiculous and he's not going to take those at the NBA level, they'll have enough other guys around him that the ball will go in anymore. 86% free throw shooter. That's great. Totally fine there. So as a shooter, I believe that he is going to be pretty awesome. Like it's and that he can be a 40% three-point shooter. And remember, also, he's only just a freshman here, right? Like you could still get to be a better shooter. We're talking about freshman.
And so the other point I want to bring up with him as a shooter, and this was what struck me, and on the positive side is very important. His pull-up shot is, like, the mechanics of it are really impressive for a guy his age. And the pull-up three is the definitive shot for point guards in the next 10 years. And, I mean, we've talked about it a lot with Donovan Mitchell. Like, Donovan Mitchell does a lot of things well. If he gets that shot, Donovan Mitchell can be an MVP candidate. Like, Trae Young doesn't do the other stuff that Donovan Mitchell does. But if you have that in your back pocket, I mean, that's really what makes Damian Lillard special, Steph Curry, obviously. And if he can get into that conversation, we just haven't seen players with his kind of other positives and negatives have that kind of a shot. So there isn't really a parallel for Trae Young in the league.
Right. And David Locke has a good point where it's like, if the guy that you're comparing to is someone who's like, and I don't know how much I buy this, but it's an interesting point, is just someone who's totally unique and transcendent, that maybe that's a problem because that guy is one of a kind, Curry or Charles Barkley or, someone like that. And a lot of it is, we've seen what Steph Curry has done, just the incredible effect that he's had on defenses. And, I don't believe that Trae Young is going to be as good as Steph Curry, but he wouldn't have to be and I don't think he's going to be number one on my board, but I thought it was an interesting way to start with the conversation of, like, with the production that this guy put up. And he's actually, the statistical translations don't hate him. I haven't looked at all the models yet, but Kevin Pelton's had him ranked number four overall. So it's not like he's looking bad on the statistical side.
So the other point, if we're talking about positives, that I think I want to bring up early is that my biggest surprise watching Trae Young footage, as somebody who had heard a lot about him, was he is a much better passer than I anticipated.
Yeah.
His vision, his unselfishness, like I had heard that about him as a high school player, and I remembered that it came up, but he was passing guys open, he was finding guys in transition, and there were a couple times where his vision got him in a little bit of trouble, where like he saw the pass and didn't really have the means. That's actually something Draymond Green does a lot, where Draymond sees the pass and then it's like he can't really get it there at the right point. But that's a much better problem to have than the alternative. And I was really impressed by that. The one kind of concern on his passing that I have is that because he's on the small side, yeah. he measured at the combine a little bit under 6'2 in shoes. I gained an appreciation for the Ben Simmonses and the LeBrons of the world because the angle of their passes, even if they see the same thing, like even if Trae Young sees the same pass Ben Simmons would see, the angle of the pass just makes it a lot yeah. easier to defend because it has to go a little higher, it's a little slower. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, and against NBA caliber athletes, that gives them time to recover, unless you're really passing the guy open where, like, you getting it to the cross court. Like, LeBron throws a couple of those, but LeBron is also LeBron. So I was very impressed with his passing, and I'm like, why isn't this as big of a story? Because he was wonderful at that, and he wasn't asked to do it that much because he was, you know, the kind of the teammates, when I was watching the Oklahoma footage, he had a nice catch-and-shoot big man along with him, but he didn't really have as many opportunities as he will in a modern NBA where there's just so much offensive capability now because that's a mandatory part of the game.
Yeah, I guess a few other notes on his passing. He did play with two big men who could go up and get alley-oops. You mentioned that pick-and-pop guy as well. And that guy could actually go to alley-oops too. They ran a lot of this set where that guy would look like he was going to go to a pick-and-pop and then get a back screen for an alley-oop. And Young always put that on target. He was a fantastic lob passer. Basically, if he got penetration, as soon as the guy guarding the man on the baseline took one step towards him, the ball's in the air for a dunk. You mentioned he doesn't have the height to see over the defense. I mean, I think he actually sees that pass. It's just it's tough for him to get it there when he's trapped, which he was a lot, you know. But I think on his penetration, I thought he was really good. One thing that he did a lot, and you could say this is good or bad, is, you know, he'd pick up his dribble and put two hands on the ball to try and find guys. Usually that would be when he'd drawn help or when he had two guys on the ball in a pick and roll situation. He would make pass fakes. But usually he would make a pretty good play in those situations. And he would find shooters on the weak side when he had the passing angle. That's the toughest pass to throw when you don't have the height necessarily. 115 of his 217 assists were actually in transition. And he was fantastic at throwing like long hit ahead passes over the defense. Like if a guy got a step on his man, he would throw it to him. Now, Young also averaged a staggering 5.2 turnovers per game and had an 18% turnover rate. So that's pretty high, even for college where there are a lot more turnovers overall. You know, that's not great. He definitely tried a lot of stuff. There's a lot of pressure on him to be sure. And he also even, you know, he would be the inbounder a lot. And he would throw these awesome inbound passes like all the way to the weak side to shooters as well. I mean, he definitely has very, very good vision. And, you know, that's something that I believe will almost certainly translate. I mean, you don't see these guys who average like 8 assists in the NCAA like not have that translate as far as being passed. As long as they get the ball in their hands, even, you know, going back to like a Kendall Marshall or something like that, like even Kendall Marshall would average a lot of assists, even though the rest of his game didn't work and then he tore the ACL. So, I mean, it is very rare that guys will put up a lot of assists in NCAA and have it not translate. I can't think of any examples of that really among high level prospects. The next thing I want to talk about is his transition play. And we've seen this with Steph Curry as well, that when you can pull up, and again, you know, this is all contingent on the ball has to actually go in. But Oklahoma was 6th in the nation among Division I teams in possessions per game, 78.8. So that's basically a pro pace, which when you have a 30-second shot clock, that's pretty impressive. They had 22% of their possessions occurred in transition per synergy. That was number 2 among major conference teams in D1 behind Creighton. And Trae Young was basically pushing all. They don't have anybody else who can even like dribble the ball up court, basically, on this team. Like they outlet the ball to him every single time. They didn't have grab-and-go guys. Now, worth noting that they weren't like a dominant offense this year. They only were 56th in Division I in points per possession overall, 77th in points per possession in transition, but they got a lot in transition. So that pushed up their 88th in the half court. And, you know, for those who don't know, there's like 300. But this guy, we already talked about the hit ahead pass, and he gets guys to run and run hard. Drag screens 40 feet from the hoop. You know, just it changes the angle so much when a guy has a head of steam, you have to pick him up almost at the half court line. You know, he's just sowing the same sort of issues in transition. And NBA teams are much better equipped with the shooters that they have, with the spacing in the NBA to take advantage of sowing chaos and transition even more. I mean, he is just Steph Curry, you know, surprisingly enough to me, is one of the best transition players in the NBA, despite the fact that he doesn't like put a ton of pressure on the rim, because he'll push the ball up and then off the ball as well. I mean, you just got to run to the guy in transition. So, you know, much was talked about with Lonzo Ball last year of like, oh man, this guy is going to like totally transform a team in transition. And the Lakers did run pretty well. And you know, he'll do the hit-ahead passes. Like Lonzo Ball did a good job in transition this year. But Trae Young, to me, is going to give you so many more transition opportunities when he's fully formed than even Alonzo Ball, because he just has to be guarded immediately and is this great off-the-dribble shooter and just is going to sow so much trouble when you have to pick him up 35 feet from the basket in transition, or you got to be totally aware of him when he's running off the ball. And that's another thing I like about him just in general, is like, he didn't play off the ball here, but you know, his fit as a point guard is really good offensively. He can play off the ball as well as such a good shooter. So that's probably, I think, the thing, kind of the transition, and then just, you know, the fact that in theory you're gonna have to double team this guy away from the basket. You know, he's probably gonna be switchable, which is an issue, but I mean, being able to get a switch against most NBA teams is pretty good. So I think just, and maybe the shot doesn't go in, you know, I don't know that for sure, that he's gonna be able to shoot the ball, you know, and he's not gonna be as good as Steph Curry. Like, no one's as good as Steph Curry. He's got, we'll talk more about his finishing and stuff like that, but just in terms of like all this, like, oh, you know, we're gonna have like these big guys be number one, and it's like, this guy is the modern NBA. Like, you are not learning the lesson of what actually wins on offense and like why Steph Curry is good to not see like what this guy's potential is. Again, I'm not certain. There's a lot of uncertainty with him. You know, we're talking about like, you know, one or two of a kind players here. But if that jump shot goes in, even with some of the other limitations we talked about, I mean, he's just going to be awesome offensively. Like he's going to be a very good offense player.
You brought it up a little bit, but the finishing is a concern. The number that I saw was 51% shooting at the rim. That's pretty damn far from great. Like, the guy that I kind of thought about there was Dennis Schroeder, you know, where that's about, you know, kind of the finisher. And Dennis Schroeder is a way better athlete than Trae Young is. Now, you can make an argument that having better spacing, play, you know, some of those lineups that'll come out there, better schemes and all that can bump that number up a little bit. But also, Young, I think with his frame and everything, he'll have to get a lot of craft to get to, you know, solid or above average as a finisher. He can be a productive offensive player without it, but that is a concern. And a lot of the fouls that I saw him draw were you've called them college fouls before, where it's like you drive into the lane and you fall down, and so they just, well, oh, that's a foul.
Let me actually push back on that just a little bit. I think that a lot of the fouls that he drew, he was like next level in terms of like, you know, you don't see guys in college like draw the same kind of bullshit fouls that guys in the NBA draw. Like, and he actually was pretty good at creating contact, like, you know, feeling the contact and throwing something up and getting a call, or like going up through guys' arms for three shot fouls. Like, guys in college don't do that, really. You know, to my knowledge, I don't watch that much college basketball, just, you know, to see some rando like junior from Kansas State or something. But generally, when we've looked at prospects, we haven't seen them have that type of game. And he averaged 8.5 free throw attempts a game, which is, you know, again, had this crazy usage, so maybe that's not as great, but you know, that's a lot of free throws. And you know, he shot it at the 86% clip. Some of them were college fouls, to be sure, but I thought that he actually like was pretty good at call seeking behavior, which for a college freshman, like, you don't see that.
I'll grant you some of that. Something else that I'm a little bit concerned on with Young, and this also might be the sample.
Are you
going to
talk about the finishing? So I want to add a little more on that.
You can go to that. It's tied in, but it can be a separate point.
Well, so he doesn't have a ton of craft finishing, right? I mean, if you talk about Steve Nash, Steph Curry, both those guys have a little more size than Young. Similar to wingspan. Young's about 6'3 wingspan, same as Curry. Curry is faster, at least certainly now. You know, Curry has worked on his athleticism a lot. I don't want to preclude that from Young, but like Steph Curry, I don't see Young just watching him out there as like, you know, a guy who can go up and like in an empty gym, like throw down some nice dunks the way Steph Curry used to be able to, still can to some degree. You know, he doesn't quite have the same quickness. He doesn't have the same alacrity to his handle as Steph does now. You know, back then, Steph was working on his handle
a lot. And that's where I was going.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's the finishing of the rim. You know, he doesn't have great kind of like hook shots and off foot finishes, but he has a really nice floater game. He doesn't release it that high, you know, and that's the same thing with his jump shot too. We'll talk about the versatility of his jump shot a little bit. But out of pick and roll, 35 points on 23 possessions on floaters, 16 out of 22 on floaters out of pick and roll. Now, he only had 60 points on 62 possessions total on floaters, but a lot of those were plays where he just kind of got in the lane. He didn't really beat his own man. He had to force it up over somebody. When he actually like can get open on a floater, which, you know, in a normal pick and roll coverage, you would expect he'd be able to do, it was money. Like, it was, you know, 22 is not that many shots, but it really looked good. Like, you could tell when he was being contested on the floater, no, it didn't look as good. But when he was kind of had a good look at a floater, if the big was back, it looked really, really good. And he also, his operation in pick and roll, it's not amazing. You know, his handle like could be tighter, but he showed some ability to get the guy on his back. Again, like had the guy run up his back and draw a foul call that way. Like, he's pretty good pick and roll operation. But you know, you were going to move on to something about like him improving his handle, I guess.
Well, I didn't think he had a lot of shiftiness. I think a lot of it is based on the respect for his jump shot. And the other thing, I didn't see a ton of burst from him with the ball in his hands in half court setting. You know, obviously in transition, he can take advantage of the space that's in front of him. And in the NBA, that can be an absolutely massive difference maker, whether you're a good shooter or a bad shooter. And he can get better at that, you know, getting more confidence in his handle. A lot of guys, that's one area that gets underappreciated in terms of improvement that can get made. But like, for example, I watched the game that he played against Colin Sexton, and not necessarily when they were guarding each other, but just seeing those two playing on opposite ends of the floor, I'd be like, Sexton just jumped off the page in those settings a lot more. And it's like, oh yeah, that's what an NBA caliber first step looks like.
Yeah. No, I mean, there have been point guards, you know, Steve Nash didn't have an amazing first step. I don't know that Steph even has an amazing first step. I do worry about, he doesn't really have any kind of ability to rise up for a two-point jumper. You know, his release is very low. It starts even lower than Curry's does, like around his waist. And just his, well, he has, part of that's mitigated by the floater. Like, he's got floater range out to like 17 feet. But yeah, I mean, the ability to, as an ISO player, it's pretty tough for him. Like, I mean, he's really got to create separation at the three-point line. Guys with length are going to give him problem in an ISO. Like, if you have a team that's a good switching team, you know, if we get late into the playoffs, for example, I'm not sure that he's going to be able to create the same type of separation and to beat guys one-on-one. But against most of the NBA, you know, he can do just fine against like a Jonas Valanciunas on the perimeter or someone like that. So you're probably going to, in pick and roll, be able to force a trap, or he'll be able to get a decent look at a shot coming off conventional pick and roll defense. He does have some pretty good creative moves. Like, I saw him do a sham god. He had this like crazy behind the back move where he picked the ball up and brought it behind his back as he was picking it up and took a shot at the end of the half against TCU. So I think like he's got a lot of creativity. You know, a lot of it's going to be confidence for him. A lot of it's going to be given a decent rope to develop, you know, because remember, again, you know, when Steve Nash took a while really to become Steve Nash, and he played 4 years in college, I believe. Curry played 3 years in college, and then, you know, so is much more of a developed player. He's going to have a lot more growing pains, even if he eventually can be talked about in the same breath as those guys, which, again, you know, the odds are against that. The odds are against any draft prospect being that good. But, you know, but he does have a lot of creativity to his moves, and I think he just loves playing basketball, loves coming up with moves and ways to get better. So I think, you know, especially as a finisher, I expect him to get better. And same thing as a dribbler.
Something else on the physicality front that was really prevalent in the Alabama game. So I said they had Herb Lewis, who was bigger. I think he was like 6'6", 6'7", on him a lot. And something Alabama started doing in the second half of that game was ball denying him when Trae Young passed off. And I don't think it was necessarily an effort-based thing a lot of the time, but it was a very effective strategy. You know, so at certain points he was trying and just couldn't really create separation. And so in the NBA, you have to be really, really good to have a team actually execute that other than in a playoff series. I mean, we saw James Harden can be effectively ball denied, and yet it's only reared its head in a couple of series over his entire career. So it's not a big concern, but it just kind of gets into one of the risks with him is just the gigantic athleticism jump that happens at every position, and yeah, just how that affects his ability to create quality looks, not only for himself, but also for other people, because the separation that you create doesn't always have to become a basket for that player unless you're Jordan Clarkson. It can become an assist. It can become a one player turning his head so that another player can get a back cut. It can be all sorts of other things. And so the definitive part for me with Trae Young is the pull-up jump shot. I think that will determine his career. But the amount of separation that he can create and how much attention he draws with everything, including but largely other than the jump shot, is a kind of a big question for me. That's not a question that's a negative necessarily. It's just something that I'm not sure of, and so that makes it harder to sell him as a, you know, as a locked in big offensive player. It doesn't hurt his ceiling because he can solve those problems. He just, without knowing it, it creates risk.
Yeah, and it could well be that he is just overwhelmed by NBA athleticism. I expect him to have like kind of a rough rookie year, I think, because it's just, you know, even if you're playing conventional pick and roll defense, just putting a guy on him who has good length, who can fight over a screen, you know, he's going to be on some bad team that doesn't have a great offensive system. You know, he's not going to be have the off-ball magic that the Warriors have developed over years and years. And, you know, I think he's going to take a lot of very deep threes, and maybe they just won't go in quite as much because he just has to rush it a little more. On the other hand, you know, he had to take so many bad shots at Oklahoma. You could say, well, he's going to be freed up from having to take as many of those, and maybe he can be a little bit more efficient, and he might actually get like an open shot every once in a while that someone else sets up for him. A lot of it's really going to depend on how much freedom he's given, where he ends up, what the quality of coaching is, the quality of offense system. And then let's talk a little bit about his defense. Obviously, the tools are not great. Now, you know, you're laughing. He had, what, 1.7?
I want to say why.
Yeah, okay.
He was, and I went back and watched dedicated film on this because I wanted to watch it. He is one of the worst transition defenders of any lottery level talent I've ever seen. He, like, there were certain plays where he did something that you almost never see a good player do, where he moved out of the way of somebody who was driving the lane when he was the lead defender and just let that guy have a layup. And it wasn't like he was in foul trouble or anything like that. There were times when he tried and when he was figured out what the other team was doing, where he was in the right place. But there would be these just super weird give ups from him that were very concerning to me for a player who has the facility that he shows on the offensive end.
Like, are you talking about like if he's just like the guy back on a transition break or something like that?
Yes. Or, like, so sometimes he would be in position to be the guy back on the break, and then he would just stop. He'd just be like, meh, I'm okay. Like, I think I watched something like 60 transition defensive possessions for him because I got kind of obsessed with this. And I think it'll be better with coaching and accountability because he's, you know, he was shouldering, we talked about the historic offensive burden he had. But there were times where I'm just sitting there going, you could be doing a little bit more and it would be making a big difference. And that combined with the physical limitations that he has, like, kind of, it built a little bit for me. Like, I don't think he's like a destined to be a sieve forever, but it's kind of like, you know, how is he going to respond to that as an overall thing? Because it's not like Oklahoma was, you know, this moribund team like LSU and Washington. Remember, Markelle Fultz and Ben Simmons were both awful defensively. I think both of those guys were worse defensively in their, you know, in their college tenures than Trae Young was.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But they had better physical tools than Trae Young does. And so there was an expectation that they could, you know, that especially the effort-based part of it. So I think Trae Young can be an okay defender at the next level, but I saw some things that really bothered me.
And he's going to be a defensive negative. Now, again, you know, he's a guy who, and we'll say this for so many of the prospects, I think sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad that around draft time when we watch all our film, we've just finished watching the playoffs. I think it's good in some ways because it's like, all right, this is what basketball is like at the highest levels. You're really talking about a guy who's going to be a superstar. And defensively, like offensively, you know, I think he could struggle against the absolute best competition. You know, in isolations, he wasn't just like totally giving up. You know, he was in a stance, but he opened up his stance very easily. He could be overpowered, obviously, and only weighs a buck 78. There were teams that definitely would try to like get the switch and go one-on-one against him. But I thought that he tried. I would say that if I had to compare his effort level and intelligence to your average like star freshman point guard, I would say that he was actually, you know, a little bit better than average. You know, I think he did a decent job trying to execute. Certainly there were lapses. This transition defense thing, I'll leave that to you. I don't really have a comment on that. But I'm not that worried if a point guard is like not stopping a one-on-one transition break. With his lack of length, I think he is really going to struggle to contest jump shots. And, you know, he's not really quick enough to get into guys so much that they can't get the shot off. Like, they're able to get separation on him and then just shoot right over the top. I think, you know, and especially if he gets switched onto someone, which we're going to see quite a bit here. So, you know, he's going to get attacked for sure. You know, he's got a decent steal rate, but the tools are not good. I mean, he's going to end up being a below average defensive point guard. The question is just, you know, can he make up for that with smarts and effort? And we'll see. You know, I don't expect him to be a good defender. Now, is he going to just kill you by not trying and not executing? I am hopeful that he won't do that, that he can at least execute. And, you know, there's a lot of bad defensive point guards.
It is not catastrophic at any level other than, like, let's say the conference finals or beyond. At that point, yeah, it could be a big problem. I mean, we saw how good the best teams are now at attacking it. And if you think about Trae Young, you don't want to necessarily go, well, where is the league right now? You want to think, where is the league going to be in 4 or 5 years? Because that's more of when the
Well, apparently everyone's going to have a bunch of big men, judging by the top of this draft.
Yeah, they'll have a bunch of talented big men playing like 20 to 25 minutes a game. But yeah, I'm going to be very interested to see kind of how he fits in with that. And Young is what I find so fascinating about him is kind of going back more to get into the overall points with him is he has one of the highest ceilings for a player who has a floor that I'm very uncomfortable with. So they're like, there are a lot of guys that have high ceilings and low floors, but it's like with him, I wrote about this once for Real GM, but it's like this idea of like, well, what if it doesn't work? Like, what if the main thing he does doesn't work? And so I think that there could be that real downside with him, and that is worth considering. But then at the same point, you're sitting there going, you know, and I've watched some of the film and the other guys are like, well, shit, but what if it does work?
Yeah, yeah. And that's a big part of my thinking as well. And I mean, I'll tell you what, actually, I started this analysis kind of biased against him, you know, and I tried to think of like why that was. You know, it's just part of it was just, well, there can't be another Steph Curry. Part of it was, and I think probably the biggest thing that surprised me was the passing vision. Part of it was just we want to like not believe in these like crazy college performance guys, right? Like Jimmer Fredette is a perfect example. You know, Jimmer was 22 when he was drafted, and he was a lot less athletic than Trae Young and a lot worse passer. And Trae is probably a better shooter than certainly has more quickness and more ability to get his own shot, etc. But there is this feeling, you know, or Adam Morrison, or like, it's just like, oh, this guy's overhyped if he's that good in college. It's like, you have to be on Kentucky and kind of like have this raw potential that it's like, oh, once you get out of the college system, you're going to really blossom in the NBA. Whereas, you know, it's harder to make that argument with Young because he obviously had the greenest of green lights and everything was being run through him. And he was playing about his NBA style of basketball as you could possibly play at the college level.
And you could argue that the green light really hurt his overall efficiency because he took some mind-blowingly terrible shots.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it was kind of the nature of the beast. And I remember there was one that stuck out to me. It was, I think it was just in the random film I was watching. And it was, I think it was a minute 45 was left in overtime. And it was a tie game. And Young just pulls from like 30 feet with 22 on the shot clock. Yeah, they were down 4 in overtime with 1:45 left, and he shot a 30-footer with 22 seconds. I'm just sitting there going, what? But at the same point...
Well, and these are like contested, too. Like, it's not even like, oh, you're going to back off of me. Like, he'd shoot like these fadeaways. I mean, there's some crazy shit. Like,
well, and I alluded to this on the Twitter show when we kind of teased that we were going to talk about him, of when Steph Curry misses, sometimes it looks so bad because it's like hanging in the air for a while, the nature of the shot, you know, the confidence and everything like that. And when Trae Young had those nights when it's not falling, I think that was how the Kansas State game was, it looks awful. Like, it's kind of the understated part of this three-point variance is that you can have those games that are just so deflating, like the Rockets missing 25 threes in a row. But the hope is that he's going to get better opportunities, and I expect that he will, so that you can rely more on the foundation of his catch and shoot, more on the easier pull-ups rather than those like, oh no, I'm just going to take it from like 32 feet.
Yeah, and he still has his passing to fall back on as well. It's just going to be so interesting of like, do NBA teams need to play him like, oh, we're going to trap this guy in the pick and roll? Like, is he going to be that level of player? Are you going to have to respect him that far out? Is he going to sow that chaos in transition? You know, that's the big question. But I mean, the fact that I think he has the potential to do that, it is pretty crazy. And, you know, I mean, like we said, maybe the ball just doesn't go in for him, or maybe just the amount of length just, you know, caused him to lose confidence and he just can never adjust. And, but I, you know, I think it's more likely than not that he ends up being pretty good. And so I'm probably more interested to see how he turns out in the NBA than, you know, just about anyone that I've seen it in a long time. And I certainly enjoyed watching him, and I hope that he ends up being a pretty good player.
Oh, so that's how I want to end this, is this fascinating juxtaposition with the two players that we've watched a lot of film on and done so far. Trae Young, who is just such a natural fit for, in the best case scenario, we're close to it, you know, like let's say 60% and above.
Yeah.
For where the NBA is going.
And just for team building, it's so easy to build around him. I mean, you have to play a lot of high pick and roll probably, and like, you know, he takes a lot of shots, but he can shoot the ball. And it's like, when guys can shoot like that, you know, most of these point guards, it's like, okay, they got to have the ball in their hands. And if they don't, they're not really that great of shooters. So it's like, this guy damn well better be awesome. You know, so there is a way that he can succeed. Even if he's not like a superstar, he can still be, you know, a point guard that you can kind of fit in other guys around reasonably well.
Right. And so you compare him to Marvin Bagley, who is a world's better, you know, run jump athlete, but doesn't really have a niche, doesn't really have a position defensively in the league. And so a lot of it is going to be about surrounding talent, coaching, scheme, and all that. But the comparison between those two guys as being where we started is just fascinating for me.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to get to the rest of these guys. We're going to really lock in now that the finals are over, and hopefully be doing, you know, one of these every other day or so, maybe even more than that. Draft's coming up, though. I mean, what do we got? We got like 13 days before the draft, so hopefully we can get like 6, 7, or 8 prospects in here between now and then. And we might have to do like slightly more truncated version of some of the kind of, but wow, we've been doing this raw recording time for 1 hour and 37 minutes. Let's wrap this up here. Anything you gotta talk about before we go?
So it sounds like my offseason preview for the Sacramento Kings is going to come out on Saturday at the Athletic. It was submitted, but you know, there was a lot that was going on today, so I understand that.
Yeah,
I
rolling
will have
into the offseason strong here.
Oh, yeah. And so then I'll have a bunch of those coming out over the next little while. Most of them are done. I'm going to be writing the Cavs and the Warriors this weekend, and we'll be talking about them pretty soon on Dunked On. And then report cards for Game 4 will be at the Athletic, and I'll probably do some big picture piece over the next couple days. Thankfully, I do not have the night of responsibilities now with all of our other capable people, but there'll be something, and I'll figure out what angle makes the most.
And thanks to Sonos for sponsoring today's program. You can control music with your voice with the Sonos One. You can even have someone set up your Sonos speakers for free if you live in any major metropolitan area. Order from Sonos.com and select Up and Running at checkout, and get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com when you use the promo code DUNK10. That's DUNC10 at Sonos.com. This offer available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Once again, that's DUNC10, DUNC10. Use that DUNC10 code. Let them know that you came from us.